WCPB Channel 5 podcasts and SportsCenter 5. It's Take 5 with Chris Gasper.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of the Take 5 podcast. Today's guest, esteemed Boston Globe columnist Bob Ryan. He's a four-time National Sports Writer of the Year and winner of the 1996 Kurt Gowdy Award from the Basketball Hall of Fame. He started covering the Celtics way back in 1969. That's right, he has more than five decades of covering the Celtics and the NBA. So nobody better to ask, what's wrong with the Celtics? Bob answers that. Also, we discuss whether the Celtics need a big C change or a little C change on their roster. Bob tells us the best team he ever covered. I think you can guess that one. And he also, I think, very eloquently explains why you can't really compare eras of basketball. And then we switch it over to football, and Bob picks a side in Brady versus Belichick. Ellen, an interesting thing about Bob that not a lot of people know is that for a short period of time, he actually worked at WCVB.
Yes, much like you.
Yeah.
Big Globe guy, came to WCVB for the time being, and times were different. They were very different.
In fact, he seemed to floor you as a producer with how different times were.
I mean, he told me that they used to have like 6 or 7 minutes worth of sports coverage in a newscast, which anyone who's ever seen a local newscast, no matter the station, that's just bananas. So, I mean, that was it. I was like, okay, times have changed.
No question about it. And it is interesting because I find myself following in Bob's footsteps. And if you listen to this podcast, you'll find out Bob is somebody I grew up idolizing. He's one of my heroes. And so I was lucky enough to work with him at the Globe. And then when he retired, semi-retired really from the Globe in 2012, after the 2012 Summer Olympics in London, they promoted me to full-time columnist, taking his slot. So I didn't replace him because nobody can replace Bob Ryan, but I followed in his footsteps. And now I'm following in his footsteps here at WCVB. So obviously I've learned nothing. Like there's this saying in sports, you never want to be the guy who follows the guy. I'm the guy that keeps following the guy because Bob Ryan is as recognized and revered a Boston sports authority as you can find. And here I am always following in his footsteps, which obviously is not the best career plan.
No, but another person who he brought up is a WCVB favorite, of course, is Mike Lynch.
Yes.
Who began here during Bob's time here.
That's correct. I didn't even know that.
Yeah, everyone's connected. Everyone's intertwined.
Six degrees of Bob Ryan.
Yes. And he even said, who was the dean of sports when he? Because we always call Mike Lynch the dean of sports.
We do. You know, I almost said our generation. You and I are different generations, but yeah.
Right. I'm so young.
You are so young. Yeah. Yeah. I think he said Don Gillis.
Yes, he did. That's who it was. And I was like, wow.
So it's like the great influential WCVB sports personalities. You had Don Gillis, you have Bob Ryan, Mike Lynch, Ellen Fleming.
In that order.
I think it goes in that order. Yeah. So there you go. That's the pantheon here.
Well, yes. If you ask Mike Lynch, who is following in his footsteps, he would for sure say Ellen Marie Fleming.
Oh, definitely. And I didn't even know that was your middle name.
Yeah. Well, every girl's name, I think, in the Boston area, the middle name is Marie.
Maybe it is.
Yeah. Oh,
wow. So this has proven to be an even more educational podcast than I thought. We learn Ellen's middle name and we get an education on the NBA from Bob Ryan. He's next.
Hey, Boston, let's talk sports. WCVB Sports Center 5, The Contact.
Source at MLB tells me.
Expert analysis.
That's going to be a major point of contention.
On air.
I talked to a high-ranking source.
And exclusive articles free on the WCVB app. Duke Castiglione, Chris Gasper, Bob Halloran, and special correspondent Mike
Once
Lynch.
Again,
the strongest team covering Boston's teams.
The only game in town.
WCVB Sports Center 5 on Boston's news leader.
All right, now, as promised, we're joined by the one and only Bob Ryan, legendary Boston Globe sports writer and my personal hero. Bob, always good to talk to you. How you doing these days?
Hey, we're fine. We're healthy. We're vaccinated. We're, you know, getting a little anxious to get back and rejoin the world a little bit more. That's for sure.
Yeah, just like the rest of us. I know you're probably anxious to get out to a college basketball game pretty soon here.
Well, maybe not in your college, not until the next fall. But I have gone to Red Sox. I've gotten to 4 Red Sox games so far. And I'm a season ticket holder since 91. And we're back in the swing a little bit there.
All right. So I want to ask you here about the Celtics. They call you the commish for a reason. Nobody more knowledgeable about the NBA. I'm just going to get right to it, Bob. What's up with the Celtics team?
They are I think by acclamation, the most disappointing team in the league, based on expectation versus performance. They are also artistically annoying to a fan. You know they should be better. You've seen it. You've seen the individual and the collective performance in the past, and you don't understand what's going on. If someone had told you that there would be a team in the league, and I you can verify this number. I heard this, and it's so astonishing. I said, what? But because we're used to the idea that they're coming from behind all the time or blowing leads. She's like, so that's the only way to know how to live. You know, we live one way or the other. That they've had a double-digit deficit in 39 times this year.
Oof.
Out of six, that now they're up to 69 games.
Yes.
Well, even if it was 19, you know, be bad enough, because this team shouldn't be happening to this team. And okay, everybody's got COVID, everybody's got injuries, and they certainly have had a lot of bad luck in terms of that. Okay, but they're not the only one. What I don't like hearing and reading when these things happen is Brad Stevens having yet again to talk about the defense isn't there, the effort isn't there. I mean, how many times do they have to fall behind before in the first half before they get the message? You say to yourself, there's something wrong.
With the mix. Is there something wrong with the mix of players?
The mix. I didn't think so. I never would have thought. But apparently something's wrong. I don't know. You know, you look at these two young forwards and they ought to be set for, you know, we ought to be set for 10 years, you know. Well, Tatum has risen to a certain level. Brown has had his moments. Brown became an all-star this year. He's improved in all categories over the course of his career. But maybe they – somehow, do they not fit? I just didn't choose to look at it that way. I know one thing we do, I think we can all agree on. It's not going to end well, whether it goes out they don't have Brown now. They're going down. Whether they go down in the play-in game or games, plural, or whether they go down in the first round in what I'm afraid would be a relatively humiliating fashion. It's not going to end well. And then, do they have to make big change in next year? And where does it start? You can't bring back the same group if this thing's going to go down in flames this year.
So I agree with you on that. So we'll talk a little bit about the group and then get into the play-in round. In terms of the group, here's my question. And you hit on something that I've talked about. I love what I've seen this year from Jaylen Brown. I think his breakout performance, his evolution, his ascension is the single most positive thing that's happened to the Celtics this year. However, when I look at Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, I wonder if there's an issue there, not between them personally, but just that they're on the same accomplishment timeline, Bob. They're basically the same age. You know how it is in the NBA. Guys look to accomplish things individually, and then they're excited to accomplish things from a team standpoint. We know it was that way with Paul Pierce. So do you need to bring in a more veteran player, let's hypothetically a Bradley Beal, who's a little older, in his prime, has done some of these things and says, man, I know I'm established in the league as a legitimate superstar. I just want to win. So I look at it that way and say, that would be change with a big C. Is that the change you need? Or is it change with the small C, which to me is moving on from Marcus Smart, the longest tenured Celtic, because I think in so many ways, as good as he is, as hard as he plays, Bob, he embodies a lot of the things wrong with this team in terms of a sense of entitlement and an inflated sense of belief of one's abilities. He thinks he's a better player than he is. This team thinks they're a better team than they are. So out of those two choices, big C change, which means splitting up the Jays, little C change, which would mean moving on from Marcus Smart. Which one do you think is more likely?
More likely.
Or which one do you want?
No. Well, I mean, I think the big C is the way to go. Now, as far as Smart's concerned, I am a long time, not only am I a member of the fan club, but I've actually been on the board of directors for a while. But I cannot disagree with your assessment of his a self-assessment, if you will. You know, I can't disagree with it, and I want to like him very much. But it could. And here's the question: what's he bring? Now, here's one thing: I have any of these discussions, Chris, I have to position myself.
Okay.
This whole commissioner thing with me—that's past tense. I am not up on the league the way I was. And I don't know about contracts. I don't know all the specific contracts. And you know, you don't do these things in a vacuum in this league. You have to do them with a very, very sharp eye.
Yep.
And starts with matching up contracts, getting stuff back, this and that.
I can tell you, Marcus has a year left after this year on his contract. Right. So he'd be an expiring contract.
I would need to be appraised of all that about, and then who you're getting back and what that.
Yeah.
I don't know. But big C, little C. I like the way I like that analysis. I think a big C is necessary because I'm not so sure that the little C is going to change a whole lot, you know, in terms of talent to talent.
Hey, it certainly would be bold. Now, I know I asked you which one is more likely. I'll answer the question too. Just I had Danny on this podcast a few weeks ago, and he was preaching patience with these young guys. And I think it's more likely you see the little C change. And I'll just throw out a hypothetical because the money I think would work here. I would trade Marcus Smart if I could. I think Marcus Smart would be great with a team like Atlanta. Right. And Trae Young down there, young team. They could use a little more abrasiveness. And I think he could help them. And maybe you could get a guy back like a Bogdanovich or even Danilo Gallinari. I think those are two contracts that weigh a little heavy on the Hawks, especially because they have to re-sign John Collins. I think that could be a win-win if you brought somebody back like Bogdanovich or Danilo Gallinari, who Ainge has liked for a long time. So that's the team like I target, you know, playing amateur GM, the Hawks. I think it's a win for the Hawks. They get a little more sort of, as they say in football terms, Bob, sand in the pants. And I think that the Celtics would get back that facilitator scorer guy in the number three or four role that they lost when they lost Gordon Hayward.
You hate to mention Hayward. You go back a year ago at this time. They were entering the playoffs playing well. Hayward was everything that they hoped he was going to be. He was the facilitator. He was the perfect glue guy for this group and working well with this other two. All right, and you know, well, we know what happened. And now he's always hurt. He's hurt again. You know, and that's that. No, I think you're right. They do need something like that. I'll throw a question back at you.
Yes, go ahead.
Fournier, do you want him around for a long haul?
I do. I like him. I guess so. I like him as a player. To answer your question, it depends on the contract.
Yeah.
And what do I have to pay him? Do I have to pay him $20, $21 million a year? Then no. And that's where I like someone like Bogdanovich, who's on a 4-year, $72 million deal. He's locked in at $18 million a year. And I know you say there's only like a small difference, but again, coming off the pandemic with revenues where they are. And I also just feel like Bogdanovich, I don't want to say he's a better player than Fournier. Fournier's a better scorer, but I think Bogdanovich is someone who can take some facilitator, ball handler, point guard minutes. And I think you need that if you're moving Smart behind Kemba.
Yeah, that's a good point. Because, you know, that's an interesting theory. But I guess what it comes down to is I am reluctantly willing to part company with Marcus Smart, whom I have stood up for in print and in on the airwaves, you know, with great regularity. It's hard to imagine that we're having this discussion for these issues, which there are real. The issues are real. But I'm just saying, this is certainly not the way I thought it was going to pan out with this group.
Yeah, I don't think anybody thought it would pan out this way, Bob. And you really look at the last, you know, I've sort of taken to calling this team the procrastinators of the parquet, because you look at their last three games, all really, really important games. Chicago last Friday, Miami last Sunday, and the game on Tuesday night. And here are the deficits they faced in those games. Chicago, they got down by 22 at one point. Miami down 26 at halftime. And last night, down by 22 again in the second half. And then they'll always come back and make it interesting. This is a team like that refuses to play their best basketball until their backs are against the wall. And that's what's maddening about them.
Oh, sure. But that gets old. I mean, if a team does that, everybody, look, in the course of a year and a half, any team of any worth in the league, unless you're a complete dregs team, that, you know, hopeless team, they're going to have a day when they're going to, and because it's the NBA, and particularly in the world of the era of the three, you're going to be able to overcome deficits. You're going to be able to overcome 20 point deficits with 10, 12, 14 minutes to go. Every once in a while, it can happen. You can't make a habit of it. Nobody can. And the Celtics are living proof that it gets old. We don't want to hear about these comebacks that come from 22 down and I lose by 3 or 5 or no, I don't want to. We're all tired of this. This is absolutely no. So there's got to be some accountability for this.
Now, I just out of curiosity here, because I just want to bring this up. You know, to me, these Celtics behave like a team that thinks they're one of those championship teams that can just sort of turn it on. I know you covered teams like that. You know, the 86 Celtics, I'm sure there were other teams you covered. There have been teams in the past who are good enough to just kind of flip the switch.
Yeah, that 85-86 team, really know in their hearts, they should have been the first 70-win team. and they messed around some nights. They took a few nights off. They did, and they'll admit that. Even as early as November and December, they were doing it. They knew they were damn good, and then they came down the stretch phenomenally. But if they had a goal to win 70, that team could have been the first one to win 70. Yeah, they could flip. They play a little flip the switch thing. But you very few teams have that right or that ability to honestly do it. But that team, yeah, I saw that team do it.
Is that the best team you've ever covered?
Oh, by far. Yes, definitively. By far means that there were huge gap. No, there's not a huge gap. But yes, the difference in that team, the trump card was Walton. Having a force of that type come off the bench has never before or ever happened in the NBA. There have been great six men. Of course, the greatest of all was John Havlicek when he was a six man in the first 6 years of his career. Although he was all here's a great damn with faint praise about when John died and all the stuff was written. And of course, to talk about the great six man, that was damning him with faint praise. By his second year, Chris, he was second on the team in minutes played.
Oh, wow.
So he was coming off the bench 4 minutes into the game. Yeah, we could read 6 minutes into the game because Red had the luxury of doing that. Okay. And even from that point on, he's playing. And then 68, he played all but 2 minutes of a six game series in 69. All right. So, I mean, nobody like Walton. Bill Walton came in and changed games on a nightly basis. And plus, teaming him with Larry Bird wasn't even fair, particularly when they're playing against the backups. Walton would come in. And we would just laugh because we knew the first thing that was going to happen was they were going to run a give and go. But the difference between their give and go is Walton could vary the timing. They could vary the timing of when the delivery was going to come. Sometimes the delivery came and Larry's on the other side of the basket and he wound up making it left-handed. There was never a force like that. Walton was deservedly the sixth man of the year that year, averaging under 10 points a game. That wasn't the point, average 8 or 9, whatever he averaged. But that team, that's a trump card that no team in the history of the league would ever had that kind of a force coming off the bench. Now, the game has changed, as we know. The three is the coin of the realm. All right. So what I would – the great fantasy is you take the best of the Warrior teams, against the 85-86 Celtics. That would be a battle of whose will can you impose on the other, And it would be fascinating to see. But the game, I have to say, we're going to have to talk about eras, and the game is it's radically different. When Stadium got the 60 point game, I looked up Larry's 60 point game. Larry was 2 for 6 on threes that night, but the Danny made one. The Celtics were 3 for 9, and the Hawks were like 1 for 3. Okay, and in the Tatum 60 point game, there were 62 threes attempted by the two teams. In the Larry 60-point game, there were 9.
Wow.
So the game, this is a different species. It's a different game.
You're totally right.
It's getting harder and harder to compare eras because of that.
I want to pick your brain on the Tatum thing because I know you had a great column about Larry's 60-point game. But before we do that, because I know you said 85-86 was the best team you covered, what would be second? And I guess I'm sort of leading the witness here, but I want to know a little more about the 73 Celtics. Didn't they win 69 games and Havlicek got hurt?
I'm going to tell you, that's exactly where I was going. The next team up is the team that didn't win the title. The 68-14 Celtics of the 1972-73 season, the best running team they ever had. And that was the best running team. Then the 85-86 could run well, and they had bursts of running, but 72-73, they were totally dedicated to it. And they were committed to it, and they did. And they ran better than any Celtic team ever ran that year. They were in the playoffs against the Knicks, and it's game 3. And John Havlicek gets caught in a pick between DeBuscher and Bradley and really damages his right shoulder. Misses game 4, which they lose a 16-point lead going into the fourth quarter with one of the most egregious refereeing atrocities ever perpetrated on anyone in history. And I'm happy to say that I didn't even write it to the degree that outsiders did. So it was brutal. And the Knicks win that game in double overtime. Havlicek doesn't play. Game five, he comes back and mostly shooting left-handed. He scores 18 because the Knicks are deferential. They're like paying homage. They're not messing around. They're letting him do what he wanted to do. They saw this then win game six. He's down to nine. He's a little less. And then they got the game seven at home, which we figured, of course, they're going to win at that point. Chris, they had never lost a seventh game at home. They had lost a seventh game anywhere. And so they weren't going to lose. We figured at home. Well, Havlicek is in the game and they immediately swarm him and force him into turnover and took advantage of him, which they could have done from the beginning because they said, we got to win this game, you know? So if John doesn't get hurt, they're winning. And here's the other thing. The Lakers were the foe. The Knicks beat the Lakers in the finals. That year, the Celtics were 4-0 against the Lakers. And in those four games, Dave Cowens averaged 31 points and 19 rebounds a game against the aging Will Chamberlain, whose mobility was limited. His lateral mobility was pretty much gone at that point. And Dave was young and frisky in the MVP. and he was too much for Will to contend with. They would have won that one. Yes, that team is very dear, near and dear to my heart, for sure. And I think I put them up next.
Well, that's great. And thanks for correcting me. It was 68 wins, not 69.
Yeah, 68 and 14. 68.
And that's still the record for the Celtics, most wins in a season, is it not?
Yeah, the 67 is next.
So now, as promised, I do want to ask you about Jason Tatum and obviously the 60-point game. I was lucky enough to be in the house. I was not covering it. I just happened to be there as a fan, and I was able to coax my friend, Jay Bramble, to stay when they were down 32. And I actually said to him, it's so funny, Bob, because I said to him at halftime of the game, I said, look, you know, the Celtics obviously aren't playing well here. There's no question about that. But I said, look, I think we should stay because I feel like Tatum's going to do something special here because look at what he's doing in the first half of this basketball game. He had 24 points. I said, I think he's going to get 50 and I want to see that. Now, I was wrong. He got 60 and he made it look easy. I mean, being there in person, it was amazing how easy he made it look. So here's my question for you after that long windup. You are on record as saying that Paul Pierce is the best pure scorer in Celtic history.
No.
Could Jason Tatum eclipse him?
He could. One big difference so far is that Pierce was a real master at getting to the line. And, you know, I mean, really, you know, it was a big part of the deal. Tatum isn't that, you know. But right now, Pierce is still my nominee for the greatest pure scorer. And, you know, people, when I first wrote that, which was, I think, coming out of the 02 playoffs, 2003. You know, of course, you know, heresy, you know, what about Larry? What about John? You know, I said, yes, I'm rather fond of those two gentlemen, but we're tweaking aesthetics here. We're talking about a style. We're talking about conversation. We're not talking about results. You know, we're talking about how they do it, you know. And the fact is that John was an off the ball, you know, run around off the ball player. And Larry, there were guys who could make it difficult for Larry to get his shot. You know, Michael Cooper was one. Paul Pressey had his moments.
Okay.
Rodman, of course, you know, was good. Although, you know, Larry got up for Rodman after that initial incident. But, you know, there were guys that could make it, you know, harder for him. But no, Pierce could always get his shot. You know, he had the ability, you know, to with a good sufficient ball handling ability to clear the space anytime he wanted to set and get off a 15, 18, 20, 25 foot shot, he could get it off. That wasn't necessarily true with Larry all the time. And he was a terrific finisher on the break, Pierce. Great. Boy, would he have flourished on that 70? Oh my God. Would he have? It would have been an orgasmic experience for him to be playing with Hambone Williams. Hambone Williams was the best passer in that group.
Really?
And, backup point guard. And he was a passer. Hambone was. Paul Pierce he wouldn't believe how happy he would have been playing with him. So he would have fit in with that group. So he was a throwback player. The two great throwback players, I said, of that era, you know, of 10, 15 years ago, were the guys that would have been equally at home in 1955 or 2005 were Paul Pierce, because, you know, with all that up and down and all that moxie and all that ability to induce guys into fouls and flopping, you know, he's pretty good at that. And Ginobili, those two guys were the great throwback players, you know, of their time.
Wow. Yeah, no, that's really. So do you like Tatum's game aesthetically? I know people feel differently about it.
I really love it when he, Remember, what was the great thing about him? His rookie year. Rookie year. My God, what a first step.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
We hadn't seen a first step like that since, I'll tell you what, Sam Jones.
Wow.
Definitely 6 feet 10.
Okay.
Sam was 6 feet 4. No, Sam was noted for that first step. Sam, beautifully gracious, great. I can still see those beautiful drives. But Tatum could do the same thing at 6 inches taller and get there, you know, get do it from amazing distances. And the thing with it's my favorite word to use this thing, and it's hard. It's hard when you have certain talents to calibrate.
Okay.
You know, you got to have an inner clock. When to do this? When to do that? You know, and not fall in love with just one thing. You know, you can't go to the basket all the time. You can't settle for the shot all the time.
Yeah.
You got to know. And when you get when you got the proper balance, the proper calibration, you know, when you have those kind of multiple skills, that's when you're at your best.
Well, here's something interesting, and this is what's interesting to me. And, you know, there's so many advanced stats now in the NBA, and I'm really just starting to embrace that stuff. I think it can be really edifying, but you also can kind of get lost in it. Sometimes you just need to go by your eyes. So this is one case where what I was seeing with my eyes was corroborated by the advanced stats. You would think for a player of Tatum's caliber, he would be highly effective and efficient in ISO situations. But he's actually not. He's only shooting 34.4% on ISOs this year, despite having the 10th highest ISO percentage in the league at 18.6%. And that's one thing for me where I feel like, to your point about calibration, Bob, sometimes I think he predetermines what he's going to do offensively, and he's not really aware of the defense around him, where his teammates are, the play that can be made. He just says, I don't care what's going on here. I have the ball. I'm going to execute my move, and that's it.
That's a good point, because another thing that is true, and we keep hearing this when he has a bad night off, and you know that they're ganging up on him, they're swarming him, and this is where the other guys got to, as the Coos would have said, present themselves, you know, but that's a good point. No, this is a hard, you know, sometimes you see these scores and people, but believe me, these are great, great athletes.
Yes.
And they are well coached now. You need to you got to keep working on this stuff. Some guys just, the game is perennially easy. The guy, I think that the most that exemplifies that, you just wonder why, you know, and that's Durant. Doesn't he? I just think he makes it.
He does.
It's everything is logical to him. He's never rushed. He's never forced. He just is. He just does what he does and does it and makes it look so easy. That you'll see guys like that only on really to that degree with that level of skill on rare occasions, you know, and he's special in that regard. That would be the goal for me if he could do it. For Tatum is to figure out that next step up. You know, what does Durant know or sense or feel or intuit that I don't?
I want to ask you about an old age guy who fit the mold. And it's a mold that's, I don't want to say the mold's been broken, but the record has. And that's the big O, Oscar Robertson.
Sure.
This past week, you had Russell Westbrook surpass him for the most triple doubles in NBA history. And Russell Westbrook is on target to average a triple double for the fourth time in 5 seasons. Did you ever think you'd see anybody average a triple double for a season again, like the Big O? And did you ever think anybody would break his record?
No, and no. I certainly didn't think that anyone would ever average another. The when Oscar did it, it wasn't even taking note of, you know, hardly anybody. This became got a lot more notoriety 45, 50 years after the fact than it did at the time, because we took Oscar for granted in terms of his nightly, metronomic, relentless greatness. Oscar was the master. Oscar seldom got 40 one night and 15 the next, you know?
Okay.
That wasn't what he did. No, Oscar was 32, 29, 37, 33, 32, 30. Oscar was relentless in that 30-ish category, point-wise. And he assist, you know, he would lead the league and all that. No, I didn't. I very simple to me that if you want to compare them, I can make the case for either one, which accomplishment's better. Here's the simple, I think, easily provable fact. One, rebounds were easier to get in Oscar's day.
Okay.
The average team took more shots and missed more. Field goal accuracy has improved dramatically since 1961, 62. And teams don't have to take 110 shots to make 50 as they did in those days. All not necessarily. Okay. There were more rebounds to get and somebody had to get him. And Oscar happened to be a 6'5" guard, and he came into the pros as a rebounder, and he was a rebounder. Okay, assists, however, were much harder to get. Assists, in the interpretation of what's a legitimate assist, has evolved over the years, and I blame Magic Scoring Crew.
Okay,
I blame Magic Scoring Crew as well as the implementation of the three, and then by extension, the acknowledgement of a 20-footer. I am willing to bet that Oscar Robertson in his career never got an assist on a shot longer than like 18 feet, maybe 20.
Okay. That makes sense.
An assist meant layup.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, that guy had better not dribble more than twice on route to the basket. it totally different concept of assists. And now, can you imagine if you told Oscar Robertson in 1962 that if he threw the ball out to Arlen Bockhorn for a 20-footer that he would get an assist, his eyes would have, or Odie Smith for an assist, who the last guy saw take a two-hand set, or to Twyman or to Lucas with one of those push shots, no. So what he did for assists, much more impressive. What Westbrook's doing with rebounds, much more impressive. So that's the balance.
That makes
the scoring,
sense.
Okay. Westbrook, other people benefit more from the three than he does,
Yeah.
And
it's not a great three-point
record.
Shooter.
I think he had 1-3, it's there. It's going to add up over the course of time. But for him, it's not the big the thing that differentiates him from Oscar. It's not the scoring. But the difference is that Oscar was easier to get rebounds and assists, and Westbrook is much easier to get assists.
Just on the assist thing, I know you're saying, Magic Johnson's old scoring crew at the Forum. I think that's where it started. However, I have to say, I think it was perfected by some of my good friends over at TD Garden on that scoring crew, because Rajon Rondo would get an assist. He'd kick it to Ray Allen in the corner. Allen would jab step, up fake, dribble twice, shoot a pull-up jumper from 22 feet, and they'd say assist Rajon Rondo. That blew my mind, some of the assists that they gave to Rondo back in the day.
Yeah, that's a great point. And, I remember freaking out, Chris, one year during the playoffs when I'm covering the Western Conference playoffs. It must have been 84 when they're playing Phoenix, I'm pretty sure. And there, I watched the game, and here comes the stat sheet. And they get, Magic, 17 assists. I'm going, well, what game were they watching, So now, speaking of assist and battles, have you ever heard about the funny stories about Russell and Wilt's assist rebound titles, totals with back in the day? And, the dueling stat crews on that. Oh, yeah. There was a lot of those stories floating around back in the late 60s.
Wow.
About the end of 60s, about the rebound totals in Philly and even in Boston.
That's really interesting. Yeah, the scoring crew can make a difference. I want to bring it back to the modern day Celtics because you covered the Celtics in the early 80s and Bill Fitch had a great degree of success. But there came a point in time where he'd sort of run his course. Maybe those teams had tuned him out. There's a school of thought here that maybe the Celtics right now, the 2020, 2021 Celtics, have tuned out Brad Stevens. Do you see any evidence of that?
The thing, it's a fair question because these things happen. And you're right about Fitch. They tuned him out, everybody but Larry. This defense thing, this effort, this thing that Brad has to keep telling us, that the defense isn't there and the effort isn't. It could be that it's starting to happen and it has happened. I'm angry and disappointed and all that, but I don't know. I mean, I'm not there, but we know that these things happen, and we're seeing some incriminating evidence being happening before our eyes.
Have you ever, can you think of a coach who, where it was trending in that way, where maybe he was being tuned out and he saved it and it changed, whether they changed the personnel and that's what helped him or just something happened? Has there ever been a coach that you can think of where, the tune out factor started and they were able to salvage it?
I wish I could, but I can't off the top of my head. I'll probably remember it 5 minutes after we're done, but that's the way life is. But no, usually these things are irreversible, because the coach isn't going to admit, it's his fault or his you know, ability or whim or desire or whatever, you know. It's seldom. There might be some cases, but I can't think of any off the top of my head.
No, no worry. I was just sort of curious. You know, always good to ask the hoops historian and the commish if he can. That, to me, that just makes the point of how, you know, how irretrievable and irredeemable it can become when it goes this way, if it's indeed happening. And you're right, Bob. There is some, I'd say, disconcerting evidence that maybe it is going that way. Last basketball question before we segue to something else I want to ask you about. Give me your MVP this year, and I'll start out by giving you mine. I'm going to go with the Joker, Nikola Jokic in Denver. Obviously, you could give it to Giannis again. You could give it to LeBron every year, even though he's been banged up this year. And Steph Curry really has had an amazing season for Golden State. But I have to go with the Joker for everything he brings to the table.
I'm a Jokic guy myself. Except that the more and more I'm impressed with what Curry's been able to do with that team and for that team as much. But I don't think that a team in the eighth spot is going to provide us with an MVP if that, you know, or in that vicinity, wherever they do wind up. Right now, they'd be eight, I believe. But it's a remarkable achievement what he was able to do. But I'm perfectly comfortable with the Joker. You know, I love the guy, and I think I tell you this: if you want to make a case for him, I'm sure among many when the other guy went down,
Jamal Murray.
Yeah, when Murray went down, I said, okay, it's over. You know, as a threat, you know, I wrote him off. I mean, I completely wrote them off. Like, well, and I went like 9 out of 10, and you know the number one reason. Although Michael Porter Jr. is playing great,
he has played well.
But that's a real I'm happy for that too, by the way. But I hear good things about him as a person, and that's good. But Jokic, yeah, I think so. Oh, it's not going to be Giannis.
I guess maybe the other guy we haven't mentioned would be another big Joel Embiid would compete. Well,
Embiid,
Jokic.
You know, the big issue with Embiid, Embiid's right there. They're going to hold the games against him. You know, the games missed against him.
Okay.
Now, you know, I do submit because I had this discussion a month ago. You know, Bill Walton won an MVP in 1977-78. He played 70% of the games at most. At most, and they gave it to him. He because of how great he was. But so it's been done. But I think you need a dearth of candidates, and we don't have it. We have a glut of candidates, not a dearth. So I'm going to predict that Jokic is going to win. I think you're right.
I know I said that was the last hoops question, but I have to ask you this one because I just was looking up Jokic's numbers and I saw a name, and I wanted to ask you. You know, our good friend Cedric Maxwell famously said that Dirk Nowitzki was better than Larry Bird in his opinion. I disagree with that. I assume you do too. But I want to ask you this. Do you see any similarities between Luka Doncic and Larry Bird? Or are they just completely different players?
No. Luka is the 21st century version of Larry. And it's fair to say this is who, if there's anybody that you want to, you know, give me, for instance, with him, it's Larry. Yes, I think that's a fair thing. I'd love to know what Larry thinks about this. But I understand why you would say that. His floor vision is tremendous, you know, and he shoots threes. You never blink an eye if he gets 15 assists. I think that's fair. As far as Larry and Dirk, come on, Max. So they've always had an interesting relationship and about this. I know he's always been, and Max will kid about when he first saw Larry and he didn't believe a white guy could be that good and quote unquote, you know, and laughs it off. But he's always been a little bit hesitant to give Larry his full due.
And so now, as promised, we will pivot just quickly to the Patriots, because I want to ask, I need to get your opinion about this. You know, Brady versus Belichick. For the high ground of history, I think it's always been theoretical, metaphorical, but now it's going to be actual this year on the schedule. They're going to meet week 4 at Gillette Stadium, Brady versus Belichick. Who do you got and who do you think ultimately gets, as I like to say, who's on the top medal stand of the medal platform of history? Who gets that top stand?
I think that what happened this past year is very unfortunate for Bill Belichick. In terms of this discussion, for whatever it's worth, it's a great barroom discussion, a great sports talk show and podcast discussion. It's why we're sports fans. We love discussions like these. Of course, it's subjective ultimately. But the fact is that Brady got one more, you know, argument in his favor by what he did. But I'm not going to base it on whatever happens on that fourth game of the year. We're all looking forward to it, naturally. But the larger question is who's going to be taking the snaps on the other side of the ball, as opposed to who's taking them for Tampa Bay, and whether that guy is going to be able to, you know, compete that day with Tom Brady. But the Brady Belichick thing, look, any of these coaches, you know, we had one here long before Brady and Belichick, Russell and Auerbach. And the fact is that Red Auerbach never even got to a finals before Bill Russell showed up. Okay. And then after that, he never not got to the finals. Like, no, one time. No, Red didn't, because when they didn't make it in 67, Russell was coaching the first year. So Red never not again. He was in the finals every year. They'd lost in 58 when Russell got hurt. And that's the only time he won. Okay. So Russell won without Red because he was the coach.
He did.
His own best player. Did it twice. Anyway, we had one of those. This is fine. It's good. I think in the end, more, if we had a national plebiscite of sports fans, you know, I think you and I both agree that the fans would vote Brady.
So you're saying national, right?
Yeah.
Because I think regionally the fans would vote Belichick. I do. And I'll tell you what, this football market is an interesting one to me because it's not a traditional football market. The team didn't have a lot of success. Bill is the greatest coach of all time, but the lack of success, and I would say the relative lack of intricate knowledge of football, leads to this idea of Belichick being this all-knowing, you know, deity. He's sort of like the almighty Oz, and there's this magic factor, this mystical factor to what he's doing that people 100% buy into and think, as long as he's the coach, they're a championship team. And I don't think you would get that in another market. I really don't, but I think you get that here still. I think it's Belichick over Brady in this market.
That's interesting. Well, I'll give you that, but I would bet anything it would be nationally, it would be Brady, you know, now that he's won that extra championship.
So I can relate a little bit here to Mac Jones, because Mac Jones has the unenviable task of following a legend in Tom Brady as the long-term successor. I had the unenviable task of following you at the Globe. I always say following because nobody can replace you. And I always think of the line that Magic Johnson had on Larry Bird's retirement night when Magic Johnson said, there will never, ever, 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 ever be another Larry Bird. There will never, ever, 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 ever be another Bob Ryan. So I can relate to poor Mac Jones here trying to follow in the footsteps of a legend. But stupid me actually did it twice, people might not know, because I did it once at the Globe, and I'm doing it now at Channel 5. People might not remember that you worked here, Bob, and now I'm going to bring in Ellen Fleming, and she will help people be educated on your tenure and your time here at WCVB. Ellen?
I mean, we're hoping that you're not following all the way and going back to the Globe after coming to WCVB, but Bob, tell me about your time here at WCVB and how different the world of TV and newspaper were then. Because I read a quote by you saying when you decided to retire, why you decided to retire, because everything had changed so much by that point. I mean, you were just talking about how basketball is all about the three now and sports is all about tweeting, podcasting, things that are moving fast.
All the stuff Ellen loves.
Oh, yeah, all the stuff that I love. So what was your time like here at Channel 5?
The mechanics, of course, were totally different. If you were on the road, I mean, spring training, for example, you would record your package, and then you would drive to the airport and hand the cassette to the Delta attendant, who would then put it on the plane. They would fly it back to Boston in the morning, and then they would work on it the next day, and it would air the next night.
Oh wow,
that's insane!
That's where you did it, and you recorded you wrote your script and recorded your track so that was Exhibit A. Logistics were totally and completely different. Channel 5 was a wonderful working place. I worked with wonderful people. I was broken in by the great Dean Don Gillis, and the very supportive my producer, Bobby Clark, and then later Mike Fernandez. I had the best opportunity. It was the best station in town to see if this was the life that I wanted to lead, if this was the thing I was meant to do. And it wasn't. And it was, and I was very comfortable in the decision to leave because I knew I wasn't going to have a better, it wasn't a better, I should have been at the other places. No, this is, it was for somebody else. I found out that I just missed, the lifestyle was different. A lot of things were different that you know, I got a chance to find out. And the answer to the question was, no, is this what you want to do? But it was a very great welcoming work. But here's what I loved. I'll tell you what I loved about it. I was never anchored. I was a reporter. I had packages daily. I even had a segment called Ryan Report with a notebook. And I was like a column, little notes, this and that. I also hosted on Sunday morning, on Sunday morning open house show. I had my own interview segment. I got some funny stories about that, a couple of people. But so I was given a fair shot. But here's what I love. I love the communal aspect of working on the 6 o'clock news. When you work in a newspaper, it's a solo effort. It's like baseball as opposed to other sports. You know, you do your job. They hand you, and you know, you turn in your story, and then, you know, the paper gets dropped on the doorstep or wherever in the next morning. Okay. But you're isolated. You're not working. The only time you feel that working in tandem is in the playoffs, as Chris knows what that's like. But yes, working on a 6 o'clock, and I'm sure the same as 11, but working on a 6 o'clock news, it is a complete communal effort. And there's a lot of incredible energy. And sometimes you're delivering your own package literally a minute before airtime, because you're working hard right down to that last second. And everybody's is a very similar stories. And you're rooting for the weatherman to have a good weathercast. You're rooting for each other. And then when it was over, and this is what we did in those days, we're talking about from September of 82 until April of 84, when I worked at Channel 5, we would hang around 5-10 minutes after the end of the 6 o'clock news and just commiserate and just, hey, nice package, nice this, nice that. And then we all go our separate ways, but we always got together to kind of rehash a little bit and how the, and you felt part of a team in a way that you don't ever get that feeling in a newspaper. And I really loved that feeling. That's the great fond memory I have.
And let me ask you, I'm just going to jump in for a second. I'm just curious, how long did you guys have for sports back then? I'm imagining it's a little longer than we have now.
Nightly, 6-7 minutes. My packages were usually 2 minutes. Sometimes, you know, at least 2 minutes. Nightly, weekends, Chris, 12, 13 minutes.
That is bananas.
Saturdays, on football Saturdays, with the high schools and the colleges. Oh, yeah. No, the night we did at least 6-7 minutes. Absolutely. I know how crazy, how different it is. It was a really, truly a golden era, you know, to be a part of it. And, I was grateful for the opportunity, and you know that I have very fond memories of working there.
So since Chris is following in your footsteps here, how do you think he's doing?
Oh well, I'll have him take off
his headphones if you want.
I've been impressed with Chris Gasper from the minute he entered into our world at the Globe, and the thing I loved most of all in the beginning was that he had done his homework. He was the most historically minded and most had the most depth of knowledge about Boston and national international sports of any young person that had walked into the building. And I really was impressed with that.
Oh, thanks, Bob. That means a lot, you know, coming from you. By the way, I think you almost gave Ellen a heart attack because she not only produces this podcast, but she's a producer here of Chronicle at Channel 5. So the idea of there being 6 or 7 minutes of sports, the idea of trying to produce that or account for that as a producer. Yeah, she almost fell over.
Yeah, but you know, if you're handing somebody a 2-minute package, Ellen, to start off, you know, this was part of the deal. And that's what it was.
I think producers would kill for 6 or 7 minutes right now. It would be a lot easier than cramming 2-minute packages.
Let me tell you who started out when I was there and immediately impressed us with his tremendous work habit and conscientiousness. A guy named Mike Lynch.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, Mike Lynch came in, he came in on weekends and he started out, he came over from WITS radio. Whereas he liked the kid, he was playing Patti Page records. He was like, you heard that line. And anyway, he would do his he would do his sportscast, and then he would go right in and watch the tape and look for what I do wrong. How can I improve? He took it so seriously, worked so hard, you know, and of course what he brings to the table with his institutional local knowledge is the fact that he was a successful jock. So nobody else around here has kicked the winning field goal to beat Yale. And also a multi-sport athlete. And of course, an all around great person. But I just proud to say, maybe I helped break him in a little bit. I'm going to claim it, even if it's not true.
Yeah, you should definitely claim it. Lynchy is obviously the best. They say often in life that you don't want to meet your heroes because you'll be disappointed. That's definitely not the case with you, Bob. I had the great fortune not only of meeting you, but of working with you and calling you a colleague. And I always enjoy when we have an opportunity to speak and talk sports. You've given me some great advice, not only in sports, but on life over the years. So I'm really appreciative of you coming on this Take 5 podcast and joining us. This was just a fun discussion.
It's fine for me too, Chris. Anytime.
All right, that is the one and only Bob Ryan, still writing for the Boston Globe. Bob's semi-retired. You know, I don't think he's ever going to fully retire. He loves sports way too much. But he joins us here on the Take 5 podcast. Thanks for listening to this edition of the Take 5 podcast. We appreciate it, as always. Don't forget to subscribe and rate the podcast so others can find it and enjoy it. And now you can email us at take5@wcvb.com. We'd love to get your feedback and hear your thoughts. We'll catch you next time.